I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Madison, Wisconsin, solar power is helping an organic farm achieve its mission of improving food access. Troy Farm is a project of the nonprofit Rooted. It grows produce for donation, operates a CSA, and offers a space for people to grow their own food. For many years, it operated without on-site electricity, so produce was stored in a cooler about a mile away.
It was extremely challenging in terms of the amount of time spent having to go travel back and forth and use other facilities off-site.
Farm director Paul Huber says this was frustrating for workers and increased labor costs. So the farm installed two solar arrays, one in 2019 and one in 2023. The energy they produce now powers two on-site coolers and a greenhouse.
We have a machine that we call our giant salad spinner, which spins greens dry so that things like tender greens can hold up much better in storage.
The energy also powers a well, so staff can water crops and wash vegetables on site. Huber says solar energy has transformed the farm's operations, so it runs more efficiently and workers are happier.
It's really night and day.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs and our website.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, in brutalized Palestine, an oasis of liberation and hope, much fainter hope, that Western leaders will put an end to Israeli depravity. The U.S. never will. Look to Europe, one commentator says. That's where the whole problem began. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. You have to laugh to keep from crying sometimes. 2 years into Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, bloody slaughter and mass starvation live streamed on TV screens, the old blues song rings true for tears of joy rather than rage. Friends of Palestine should go visit Bethlehem. Clinging to the walls of a fertile valley beneath the holiest of towns, hemmed in by concrete walls, watchtowers, checkpoints, and a string of mega-Jewish colonies, a biologist named Mazen Kumsieh, his partner Jesse, and friends are planting native Palestinian seeds, raising chickens, rabbits, and fish, and offering up habitat for insects, birds, bats, and other native Palestinian wildlife, rescuing their beloved landscape from Euro-North American land thieves and eco-vandals. The Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, their OASIS is called, perched above the Institute's splendid gardens, a 1,200-square-meter museum is now nearing completion. For an update on the Palestine Institute's new museum and gardens beneath, we reached out to Mazen Kumsieh. Mazen, welcome to the Green Planet Monitor. I go on. How are you?
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me on this show, and thank you for doing this. How am I doing? I'm doing as best as can be expected under the circumstances. We keep plugging, we keep going, we keep hoping that sanity will rule over this troubled corner of the world or part of the world for us. But this part of the world, of course, the troubles have reverberations globally, and we already see them in changing world politics and all of that. So we remain a pivotal part of this very small planet, actually, when you think of it compared to the universe. It's a tiny blue planet that we share as humans. And we have to learn to share it, and we have to learn to protect it, and we have to learn to respect it. As you mentioned, our motto at the museum is respect, respect for ourselves, respect for other human beings, and then respect for nature, the animals and plants that share it with us. So this is our vision, our mission in life. And it keeps us sane, it keeps us going, it keeps us hopeful. And so I sleep well at night, partly because I work very hard in the garden during the day and typing on my computer. And so I'm exhausted by the end of the day, which is usually 15, 16 hours a day, solid work as a volunteer. I'm a volunteer here. But this gives me the peace of mind that at least I'm doing my part in this troubled world, and so I'm okay.
Tell me about this museum that's now, is it now starting to operate above the Palestine Institute, above the gardens?
Yes, we actually received some visitors today, a group of children testing it. It is, of course, not complete by any stretch of the imagination. We're working on the furniture. We're working on the various exhibits. We continue to work on them. But at least we have the space, and we could spread out the collections that we have, the exhibits that we have, and we have a nice garden around it. I'm also half of the garden in the uphill. We're constructing as a peace garden, where people could come and have some peace and quiet, contemplate the world while enjoying nice flowers and herbal plants and nice smells and birds around them. So even today I planted three very important local trees in that peace garden. And so I'm hoping that we will actually have a public opening by the end of this year, if not by January 2026, as a public opening. But for now, I am receiving some students and stuff, and we use those also as a way to test our system. So when we developed an exhibit, we asked them what they thought of it, if they would suggest improvement in it, things like that. So it's a community museum. So the community really has to have input in its design and its structure. That's why we kind of open it for visitors, but it's not fully open yet. And I don't have, I'm not taking admission, so to speak.
But I mean, all the stories coming out of the West Bank and, of course, Gaza are stories of death and destruction. The Israeli military just demolishing Gaza, reducing it to a finer and finer grade of rubble, 60,000 dead, probably as many as 200,000 if you look at those who've died from direct and indirect causes. And in the West Bank, East Jerusalem bulldozing homes, I think since the start of, October 7th, 2023, if you were to choose that as a start date, Israel has demolished, I don't know, out of like 20,000 structures in the West Bank, a huge number. I don't know exactly the number, but it's stories of destruction. And yet what you're doing is you're building up something. This is a story about actually building up this institution, which is going to be regionally and globally important, this museum. And of course, there are the gardens and the institute below, which are amazing for anybody. Folks who are listening should consider going to visit the place. But you're building up, aren't you? You're constructing.
Yes, and this is an important point that you make. I mean, yes, 40,000 Palestinians in the West Bank are homeless. Their homes are destroyed. Over 2 million people in Gaza are homeless. Their homes are destroyed. They're living in tents, but those tents are being bombed too. So the situation is horrific. So some people wonder why are we building in the middle of this destruction.
I mean, it's amazing because just as an aside, people might ask, and I've asked before, boy, I mean, does the military ever come in to bulldoze things, and are you being predated on by settler terrorists?
I mean, just in the past 2 days, we have a mobile museum, mobile educational unit that goes to marginalized villages in the West Bank. And our team is in the north of the West Bank near Qalqilya and Jayous and those areas. And they were stopped already two times, once yesterday and once today, where they went through and inspected them, delayed them for hours, you know.
At a checkpoint, a military checkpoint.
Yeah, military checkpoints, harassing people who are basically, you know, people trying to bring love of nature and environment to children in those villages. So it is certainly harassment and certainly not nice, if you want to use that moderate word. But again, why, you know, why do we build while there is destruction all around us, while there is harassments, while there are people being killed and so forth? And the answer is very simple. It is keeping us alive, keeping hope alive, keeping, as you said, an oasis of hope in the middle of this mayhem. This oasis of hope keeps us, first of all, us, the employees, the volunteers. I'm a full-time volunteer. Keeps me thinking of the future and hoping for the future, and not to be overwhelmed by the horrors of the present. And this gives us optimism. Why it gives us optimism? Because we are working for something better long term. It means we believe in something better long term. We believe in having museums. We believe in having art. We believe in having music and culture. We're not going to just go to our gas chambers or death chambers or, you know, with willingly and nicely. You know, we are going to try our best to sustain life, even though others want to promote death and destruction.
And this is a national endeavor. This is an endeavor aimed at promoting self-determination and building Palestine. Like here, amongst the items, the elements that you foresee coming into existence at the museum once it's fully running, exhibits on Bedouin and village life, an exhibit, and a Palestine history timeline, and evolving maps of Palestine. That's interesting. And an olive tree corner. So this is, I mean, the Institute now in the gardens is more than just a place where you're showcasing innovations that promote sustainability or conserving biological diversity. It's a project to rejoice in Palestinian culture and build Palestine up. Isn't it?
Right. And this is also an important point to consider. What we are doing is basically also a form of resistance, because what do the colonizers want in any situation of colonization, be it in the Americas, for example, North America and South America, or Australia, or the Dutch and British in South Africa? What they want is to obliterate indigenous culture and also cause damage to the environment and reshape the environment to make it look European. This is precisely what happened here also, to disconnect us from our heritage, disconnect us from our land. The museum and the work we are doing at the Institute in general, not just the museum, but the research, the education, the community service conservation, is doing the opposite of that. It's reconnecting us to the land. It's emphasizing the indigenous people, us, the Palestinians, the Canaanites, the narrative of those indigenous people, the story of those indigenous people, the culture of those indigenous people. So hence it is a form of resistance to colonialism. And most resistance, by the way, to colonialism is nonviolent. This is a nonviolent form of resistance.
And when the children come through, and lots of children, young people come through the institute, come through the gardens, and they're large and boisterous and always fascinated by the things that they see, the plants and the animals, and they're learning about Palestine. Like, I remember I sat in on a session in your library museum with the glass cases, and there was a group of school kids there and somebody from the institute delivering a presentation, and she was so showing students a map of Palestine. I thought that was very interesting. It was like all of Palestine, not broken up into West Bank and 1948 Israel, but Palestine as a single entity in green with beautiful things painted on the map. And I was just imagining what it would be like for one of those kids looking at this, being Palestinian.
Yes, indeed. You know, children, they come to the museum. Of course, you know, they see destruction around them, even though most parents try to shield their children from the horrors of the conflict and what's happening in Gaza. But you cannot completely shield them. So they watch things. They see if they play with computers, they can see things on Facebook and on social media, other social media, etc. So it's hard to insulate them from bad news. But here they come to a museum and they see unity and they see strength and they see resilience and they see hope. As I said, Palestine is one country, 27,000 square kilometers, that now Palestinians are mostly outside the country. And the ones inside the country are divided into like Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians in the Naqab, Negev, Palestinians in the Galilee, Palestinians in the West Bank, those in Jerusalem. You know, this is an apartheid Bantustan-like system of ghettos for the Palestinians. The children feel it outside. But here at the museum, they see all these imposed divisions and fragmentation is dissolved away, at least visually, that they see that indeed we are all connected, we're all one people, and that we respect, you know, of course, we teach them that Palestine was multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, and even multilingual society before 1948.
And a place of just very rich biological diversity as well.
And rich biodiversity. And so they see that they can respect other people with other religions, if they happen to be Muslim or Christian, Palestinians. They respect each other, but also they respect Jews and others, Druze and Baha'i and others who made the fabric of Palestinian society before 1948. A rich tapestry of diversity, human diversity, as it was also with biological diversity. And the diversity is strength. So that's what we teach them, is diversity, whether biological or human, is strength, not a weakness. And that movements that try to push for having one form or one, for example, instead of diversity, of trees having only pine trees to look more European is not a really healthy ecosystem. Diversity of people is not a healthy ecosystem to have only Muslims or only Jews or only Christians or only whites. That is not a healthy system.
Now, this new museum that's rising up, it's already there. It looked pretty solid when I was there. There were people working on it. 1,200 square meters is large. I'm wondering, if I can ask how you've managed to finance this, how have you pulled this together? It's a huge project. And what do you need in the way of assistance to bring it fully to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, we started this with individual donations. My wife and I donated initially $250,000, which is what we saved while living in the United States. Some of what we saved for our retirement, we donated. We're still donating more. We will donate more. Recently, even my son is going to donate. He lives in San Francisco. So friends and family and colleagues donated. Then we applied for some grants for the building, and which needed more than individual donations. And we got some donations, including from a very wealthy Palestinian family, the Munib al-Masri family. We got some aid from foreign governments, even partial for some restricted grants. But now we are reaching, you know, the crescendo, if you want. This project will cost close to $2 million, $1.9 million. I managed to raise about $1.4 million. So I'm still short about $500,000. I have now a matching grant for $100,000. So I'm hoping by September I'll raise $100,000 from individual donations. And that will get us very close to finishing the main aspects of the museum, the exhibits, interactive exhibits, etc. But it's a process in the making. We're not going to finish everything by September. So, as I said, maybe January 2026, I'll have all the, hopefully, the resources. And people, your listeners certainly can donate. It's tax deductible for our institute, part of Bethlehem University. And they can check us out at PalestineNature.org, PalestineNature, one word, .org.
And we'll link to all those spots on the internet at the Green Planet Monitor, and I'll mention that at the end. So, Mazen, again, I mean, is the place safe? This is a question I've asked you before. It's on the campus of Bethlehem University. I think the building is officially owned by Bethlehem University. Is it in Area A?
Yes, we are in Area A.
Which is the area that the Palestinian Authority ostensibly exercises full security and control over, although the Israelis, the military, come in as they please.
Yeah, the Israelis enter it all the time in Area A and do whatever they want to. And certainly Gaza Strip was mostly Area A, and we see what happened there. They basically obliterated the whole strip. So nothing is guaranteed in life, but that is what life is about. There's no guarantees in it. We should just keep going, keep building. Somebody once said that, I forgot who was a famous person, he said, even if the world is ending tomorrow, I would still plant a tree today. So we have to keep planting, keep growing, and keep hoping for the best.
I mean, this is the here and now of liberating Palestine, isn't it, and achieving national self-determination?
Yes, I mean, it's a process. You know, peace, as I think it's Martin Luther King who said, peace is not a destination, peace is a way. So the way you live your life and the way you act is what's important, and that in itself is a win. When you are living, as I said, when you are growing, when you are planting seeds, when you're planting trees, you are engaged in living as life should be lived. And this is basically what we are doing and what I hope all people continue to do, because that's ultimately how we change the world and prevent the endless bloodshed.
Mazen Qumsiyeh is a Palestinian scientist and author. Together with his partner, Jesse Chang, Mazen founded the Palestine Museum of Natural History and the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability. Mazen has published over 150 scientific papers and books on topics ranging from cultural heritage to biodiversity. We'll return to Mazen at the end of today's program. Genocidal war on Gaza drags on with no end in sight. Mainstream commentators with some degree of sympathy for the Palestinian people argue that Israel needs to be pressured to end the war. Others say Israel's got to be forced to withdraw from Gaza and indeed to terminate its entire occupation of all Palestinian territories. The International Court of Justice, the World Court, issued an advisory opinion over a year ago now that Israel's occupation was unlawful. In the wake of the ICJ's ruling, the UN General Assembly issued a resolution calling on Israel to end its occupation within a year. That would be this coming September. It's unlikely to do so. The US won't pressure it, let alone force it. The US and Israel are blood brothers, conjoined twins. Israel, USA. So hope turns to European capitals. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that France would formally recognize the state of Palestine. The UK may follow. Keir Starmer is much more weak-kneed than Macron. Last May, speaking to a people's tribunal on the Gaza genocide in Sarajevo, Israeli historian Ilan Pape offered thoughts on the situation.
I would prefer here two historical explanations. One is more historical, the one is more contemporary, for probably the most bewildering aspect of what happened since the 7th of October for many of us. I think that we were less, and unfortunately, surprised by the nature of the Hamas attack on the 7th of October. And most of us, I think, were not that surprised by the level of brutality shown by Israel in reaction to the 7th of October, or rather how Israel exploited the 7th of October in order to implement its policies of elimination. And in many ways trying to complete, or that particular Israeli political elite that is now in power, trying to complete what the old elite of 1948 was unable to do when it expelled half of Palestine's population within nine months in 1948, destroyed half of Palestine's villages and most of its towns. It is not only the Palestinians that are calling the period between 1948 until today, the ongoing Nakba, or Nakba al-Mustamirra. It's also the Israelis who are talking very openly that the last operations in Gaza since the 7th of October are an attempt to complete what was incomplete in 1948. So I think these two elements of the situation, or these two aspects of the situation, namely the nature of the Palestinian resistance and the way it unfolded on the 7th of October in particular, and the nature of the Israeli retaliation and overall strategy since the 7th of October are not a topic that I think the Gaza Tribunal in particular needs to engage too deeply with, because I think there is already great literature and analysis of all of that. I do think we are lacking very much an analysis why the West, and in particularly Europe, and particularly Western Europe, has shown that kind of indifference, even when the reality on the ground unfolded in such a way that you would have thought that any person with a modicum of decency in them would not remain indifferent, or any politicians looking at it would not remain passive